From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2003 when a native of the Rochester area moved back home. Robin Wilt went to Pittsford schools and then moved to the Pacific Northwest with her husband and young children. But they found themselves spending most of their vacation time coming back here. And in 2003, they decided to make the move permanent. Robin launched a real estate brokerage, and while working with her husband to found the Genesee Valley chapter of the Progressive Democrats of America, and they worked for political campaigns. Then Robin launched a campaign of her own. She challenged State Senator Joe Robach in 2010. She did not win, but she was not done with politics. Last year, she helped make history in the Rochester area. She was one of three African Americans to win office on town boards, and she won her seat in the town of Brighton, the second woman of color to win a seat on that board. And Wilt is setting her sights higher. She recently announced a campaign for Congress, running to fill the seat of the late Louise Slaughter. Wilt will compete with fellow Democrats Joe Morelli, Adam McFadden, and Rachel Barnhart. And the election is less than 2 months away. It's at the end of June. It's a virtual sprint, about 7 weeks until that primary. We'll be sitting down with all of the candidates for this congressional seat in a series of conversations. And our first in the series is with Robin Wilt, who is my guest on Connections. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Evan.
It's wiltforcongress.com if you want to check out more information. Wilt is W-I-L-T. And the first thing Robin said when she walked into the studio was something along the lines of, you know, sort of a surprising development. And I said, really a surprise? You were more remarking on the fact that so many local Democrats who had an affection for Louise Slaughter really thought, you know, it was hard to think of her not filling that seat. And then her passing happened and reality sort of set in. Is that kind of what you meant by the surprise?
Absolutely. I think that we'd all gotten so accustomed to Louise's representation and all that that represented that we didn't think that the ride would end. And so I think we were all caught off guard at her sudden passing.
Now, you just were elected to the Brighton Town Board last fall.
Yes.
And now here you are running for Congress. How quickly did you decide, after hearing of Ms. Slaughter's passing, that you were going to run for this seat? How much had you even had it in the back of your mind previously?
Well, I think that's a hard question to answer because I don't think there was a lot of anticipation involved because, like I said, Louise had already announced that she was going to run for office again, and we were all supporting her. And I think then when the unthinkable did happen, there was that period of shock, and before you knew it, you had to make a decision. And for me, that decision came very organically. People had talked about my potentially putting my hat in the ring for the seat, and I wasn't convinced. I wasn't sure if I saw myself in that position. But then as circumstances aligned, I felt that it was the right thing to do. It was what people were clamoring for, and I was anxious to provide that voice for people.
Who were you hearing from? Who was talking to you about this?
Well, I've been involved in a number of progressive organizations over time, environmental groups, single-payer healthcare groups, social justice activists of all sorts. And those were the people who were really clamoring for me to throw my hat in the ring.
Do you think the Democratic Party needs to move to the left?
I do. I do. I think that the insistence on neoliberalism and corporatist democracy has proven a failure of sorts. And we need to focus on policies that will help people and working families.
Okay. And I ask that because for some listeners, and this is a little too reductive, but they like to get a sense of where on the spectrum candidates, whether the Republicans, Democrats, or otherwise may be, whom they may have supported in the past. Were you a primary Clinton or Sanders person?
I will say that I was a Sanders delegate.
A Sanders delegate. Okay.
Yes.
And so, listeners, if you've got phone calls or questions, we're going to talk about a number of issues that Robin Wilt would want to focus on in Congress. And this is a chance for you to weigh in as well as we move toward just 7 weeks away, the Democratic primary in the race to fill the seat left by the late Louise Slaughter. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And we will spend the bulk of this conversation talking about Robin and her background and her platform. But I do want to ask you if you think the one of your opponents is sort of, I think, acting like an incumbent. Joe Morelli is someone who has worked for a long time in Democratic politics. He was a party chair, of course, Assembly Majority Leader for a long time, long been talked about for potentially running for the seat if Louise Slaughter ever decided to retire, and now, unfortunately, with her passing. And so he's running, and there were a lot of Democratic establishment folks lining up with him. And it felt in some ways like an incumbency. We haven't been able to nail him down either to come on this talk show, though I know he will, or for debates, et cetera. Do you think that there is sort of an air of kind of presumed incumbency with him?
Absolutely. Joe Morelli does represent the Democratic establishment in the Monroe County region. And so he is the presumptive candidate. But I think that right now, especially at this point in history, people are yearning for something different. They're yearning for a different conversation. They're tired of politics as usual, and they want to see their voices represented by our representatives. They're tired of the horse trading and really the cynical attitude that established politicians have, that they don't need to interact with the people. They can make deals, and that's how we govern.
Do you know Joe personally?
I do know Joe personally.
Okay. Do you like him?
Yeah, I think all politicians have that likability.
Okay. And do you think he has done a good job in office?
I think that he has done a good job in a number of areas. Our differences are philosophical and also legislative. For instance, he did not vote in favor of Healthy New York Act. Joe likes to say that he is in charge of the most progressive legislative body in the country. But if you don't vote with that legislative body on those progressive issues, then you can't take credit for that.
He has said on this program in the past, for example, when the governor had a wage board looking at minimum wage just for the restaurant industry, for example. His point was simply, we can talk about minimum wage, but why are we going to target it for any specific industry? He has, I think, in some ways, questioned whether a single payer could be paid for, but I don't want to speak for him. And I've just been told that he will be on the program in late May. So we've got Rachel Barnhart later this week, Adam McFadden next week, Joe Morelli late May, and that's on the Democratic side of the candidates for Congress. The primary coming up on January 26th, so that's coming up. But the reason I ask about this is just to help understand the contrast. Do you look at Joe Morelli, for example, as someone in what you would call a neoliberal part of the Democratic Party?
I would. Joe Morelli has not been strong on a number of issues that I would consider progressive and it was things that I wouldn't even necessarily consider that progressive, like pay equity. I think that's established good policy, yet Joe Morelli has not always voted in favor of pay equity.
Now, where specifically? I doubt he would agree with that construction that you're making there. Where has he not voted with pay equity?
In terms of pay equity for women and underrepresented groups, Joe did vote against that in his legislative body.
Okay. Is there a piece of legislation you're talking about? What I want to be as accurate as I can. So.
Yes. I don't have the bill numbers here, but...
Okay, so that's part of a record that you see him establishing that you oppose.
That's correct.
Okay, we'll try to drill into that more in the future. Let's talk more about your own background here. You grew up in the Rochester area, yes?
Yes, I attended Pittsford Schools.
Went to Pittsford Schools.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Rochester area. I am a first-generation American. My parents immigrated from Guyana, South America. And really, my life is kind of the embodiment of the American dream. My parents immigrated with $40 in their pocket, and through the educational and economic opportunities that were made available to them in this country, they were able to raise me and my four siblings under relatively comfortable circumstances. And I would like to see that dream perpetuated for everybody.
What is the GDP and the economic sort of success and stability of Guyana?
Guyana probably has more expatriates than it has current residents.
It's tough.
Yeah, it's very tough. It is considered a third world country.
So when you hear the President of the United States use the term that he did, that I'm not going to repeat, talking about countries and then contrasting that with Norway, and I think it's a term that most people will still remember that he used. And to be fair, the White House has questioned whether he used that exact term, but there's been acknowledgement that he was disparaging about countries that I would say are probably with the same sort of political and GDP and sort of socioeconomic status as a Guyana. Did that feel personal given your family story?
It did feel personal. It did feel personal. I know that my family worked very hard, and it wasn't just the opportunities that were made available to them. It was through hard work and dedication and grit that they were able to succeed in this country and then have the next generation succeed. So when we talk about foreclosing those opportunities, it is very personal for me.
How did you like going to Pittsford schools?
Pittsford schools are excellent schools. They are not the most diverse district, and so I think I struggled some in that regard. And when I moved back to the area, I did choose a little bit more diverse district in Brighton to raise my own kids. Obviously, I've reaped a very good education from Pittsford schools.
Just next hour, we're talking to local high school students about summits that they have put together about race in schools. And I wonder, going back to your own childhood, did you experience racism in schools?
Yes. The first time I was called the N-word was in third grade in Pittsford schools. So
third grade?
Yes. Yeah. I attended Barker Road Elementary School, and Barker Road was both an elementary school and a junior high school. And so my classroom was kind of on the border. So the nearest bathroom was more on the junior high side than it was the elementary school side. And I was confronted coming out of the bathroom by older kids, and that epithet was thrown at me, and I was very upset. I didn't know who they were, and never did actually find out who said that to me, but yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. And coming up a little bit, we'll talk about an experience that her son had, that the Wilt family is part of established case law now in Washington state over something that happened when they lived in Seattle. We're going to talk about that in a moment, because I think that informs some of Robin Wilt's activism and work in politics, what you'd like to do in Congress. Before we get there, you did mention that when you moved back to Rochester 2003,
yes,
you chose Brighton.
Yes.
Because for a number of reasons, but let me ask you directly, why not Rochester schools? Why not say, hey, this district could use some real enthusiasm and fire and some help, and I'm going to choose Rochester. You chose Brighton. Why not Rochester?
Well, I think you naturally migrate to what you're accustomed to, and coming from the Pittsford School District, I think Brighton and Pittsford tend to be looped together, but Brighton is considered kind of like Pittsford, but a little bit more diverse. And that was our goal, for very solid school districts. I know that Rochester schools have struggled, and that is unfortunate. It's due to a number of factors that I think that we do need to address in this area. But for my kids, I chose Brighton schools.
You've been happy with that?
Yeah.
And you also got involved, as I mentioned in our introduction, pretty quickly getting involved in politics. So tell me about, kind of take me through your history in politics locally. I think that will inform our listeners who are thinking about whom they might want to vote for next month again in this primary that's 7 weeks away. Take me through your sort of local political history, if you could.
Sure. So actually, my entree into politics comes via a pretty sobering story. In November 2004, my brother was blown up by an IED in Iraq. My brother is a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And at the time, my youngest son, he was just 4 months old, and I was breastfeeding at the time. But of course, like any family, we responded immediately, hit the road, headed down to Walter Reed Army Medical Center in order to care for my brother and see him through the dozens of surgeries in order to bring him home in time for Christmas. and we were successful in that regard. He came home in time for Christmas to great fanfare here in the Rochester area. He was considered a local hero. And after that, though, I realized something. I realized that I could not afford to sit back and let others determine the policies that will affect my family, affect indeed all working families. I decided that I wasn't going to get mad, but I was going to get active. Because it was military adventurism that put my brother in harm's way, but it was single-payer health care that saved his life. So for me, that mantra of healthcare, not warfare, which is the mantra of Progressive Democrats of America, was very personal. And so I spent a lot of time thereafter engaged in civil actions. My sons have been involved in parades and rallies and lobbying visits to their representatives since they were able to walk. And time after time, we would make our case, and our representatives would agree politely, shake our hand, kind of send us on our way, and then do whatever lobbyists or the corporate interests or their cronies told them to do. And after doing this a number of times, I decided that maybe I was sitting at the wrong side of the table. So my activism really changed into electoral politics. And I've been fighting on the front lines, advocating for policies that help working families for the last decade and a half. Policies like single-payer health care, pay equity, a living wage, LGBTQ rights. I was very much involved in equal marriage in New York State. You name it. I've been out there on the front lines fighting for it. And I think that's something that is part of Louise's progressive legacy, that activism turned political advocate. And that's kind of how I model my political aspirations.
When was the first time you met her?
Oh, my gosh. You know what? Louise Slaughter she was the member of Congress that nominated my brother to the U.S. Military Academy in West Point. So that was way back in 98. And obviously, I didn't interact with her personally then, but she's kind of always been part of my life. I think the first time I met her was at a lobbying visit for single-payer health care in 2008. That's the first time I was sitting in her office, and we actually had significant interactions.
And probably never imagined you'd be 10 years later running for the seat that she occupied. But yeah. I'm curious to know, given your criticism of the Democratic Party as being too neoliberal, you know, Mrs. Slaughter supported Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, who are often discussed in these terms by what I would call the Bernie Sanders sort of faction of the Democratic Party as being less than satisfactory in regards to what they perceive as neoliberalism. Do you think Louise Slaughter was a neoliberal?
No, I think Louise Slaughter was evolving on a number of fronts, as our political spectrum is evolving right now. When I first lobbied for single-payer Medicare for All back in 2008, she wasn't terribly receptive, but she did sign on to HR 676 by the time of her passing. So I think there's been an evolution. I think really there's the growing realization that this is healthcare is a human right, and we need to promote these policies. There's no reason why the U.S. should be ranked 37th among nations in terms of healthcare outcomes when we spend $3 trillion a year on healthcare. It's unconscionable.
Now, there is some dissonance that does happen when voters talk about their opposition to single-payer healthcare, but their love of things like Medicare.
Right.
And you mentioned your own brother. And you thought single-payer health care served him well. But for the listeners who go, wait a second, we don't have single-payer health care.
Well, the military is single-payer health care. It is a system that is 100% controlled by the U.S. military. It's staffed by the military, and it's for the benefit of service members. So,
But on a broad scale, on an American society-wide scale, can we afford it?
Absolutely, we can afford it. You know, a wise man once said, don't tell me what your priorities are. Show me your budget. And there's plenty of room in the budget for a lot of these policies that more progressive type of representatives do advocate for. It's just a matter of prioritizing the things that everyday working families find important.
And so where? I don't disagree that in a budget of that size, you're going to find some places you think you can trim. Where are you going to start?
Well...
Or is it a matter of raising revenues? Is it a matter of raising taxes on different segments of the population?
Well, I do think that there are a number of things that we could do in terms of realizing efficiencies within the current healthcare system. I think we have layers right now where there are intermediaries that aren't necessarily making our system robust. They are just drawing from the system. And I think by removing private health insurance companies, we will realize a big savings. We know this because Medicare operates a lot more leanly than private health insurance.
How high in your list of priorities if you're elected to Congress is single-payer health care?
It is very high on the list.
It's right up near the top?
Yeah, yeah.
WiltForCongress.com if you want to learn more, WILT. And we'll get to some of your questions coming up. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. We are just about 7 weeks. 7 weeks today?
Yeah.
From the primary.
Yeah.
7 weeks today. What is that like, running in an election for Congress, of all things, where you have 2 months?
It's extremely stressful. you know, when I ran the Senate race, we had an 8-month time frame. And I was looking at that calendar and I was looking at all the milestones and goals that we needed to achieve. And I said, well, everything that we needed to achieve within a month's time frame, we now need to achieve within a week's time frame. So it's almost an inhumane process. It's so busy. But, you know, I've enjoyed getting out there, meeting people, and the breakneck pace. I mean, on the one hand, it's a breakneck pace, and it's very stressful. But on the other, you know, it's not too long until it's over, at least the primary portion. So,
well, you know, and we're just used to campaigns that take forever. In Canada, they do their prime minister election in something like 11 weeks. So,
right.
You know, maybe this is a new model. And you, if you're a member of Congress, if you win the primary and then win in the election in November, and you go to serve in Congress, are you going to push whoever is in the White House to consult Congress more for actions of war? I think about your brother. In Iraq, right? It was in
yes.
Iraq. And you think about the considerations that this White House has in regards to military action in many different places of the world. And you use the term military adventurism.
Yes.
I'm curious to know if your brother agrees with that term. Does he think that term's correct for talking about what happened in Iraq?
Well, I think that he would agree that when we deploy our military, it should be very strategic. You know, I'll tell you a story, Evan, because my oldest son, he now attends the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And I was at Cullum Hall, which also serves as a memorial to fallen USMA graduates. And they have the list of, they have a memorial to every single, in every single war that the U.S. has participated in. And so Civil War, right on up to the Global War on Terror. And all of the other conflicts besides the Global War on Terror, they encompassed, you know, 4 or 5 years. That was a long engagement. You get to the Global War on Terror, and we've been engaged in the Global War on Terror since 2003, and there's no end in sight. In fact, my son's shield that was just revealed back in March, it has an homage to the Global War on Terror, and they fully expect that they will be deployed into the global war on terror. This was a conflict that we entered into with no strategic means of exiting. And I think that we really need to look at that. Who does it serve? Why are we still engaged in the global war on terror? What's our exit strategy?
Whether it was President Obama, President George W. Bush, the current White House, do we need to see executives get back in a mode of really consulting Congress before actions of war?
I think we do. It was the notion of preemptive war, preemptive strike, that that doctrine is how executives are able to engage in war without really consulting Congress. And I think we need to revisit that.
Let me take a phone call. And this is Mary in Rochester. I'm with Robin Wilt, who's running for Congress. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi, Robin. I just tuned in. I just wanted to say that I support you 100% on making it a priority to go to a single-payer program for our health insurance. I think that the HMOs have been robbing us for years and years. And if you can work with Congress and get that accomplished, it would be huge. I also have a son who's been in the military. I call myself half Republican and half Democrat. I am not right on one side and not fully left on the other. And I really find it to be a difficult position to be that kind of a voter. So anyway, I just wanted to leave that to you. Good luck to you. And I'll hear what you have to say off the air. Thank you.
Mary, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Robin.
Mary, thank you so much for your support. And I feel like I have a foot in two worlds as well. West Point is very tradition bound, and I find myself engaging with other parents often. And there tends to be a very conservative mindset in some regards. But I will say that if we focus on the troops, then, and if we put our priorities first on the human element, that we will reconsider the policies that we have with regard to deploying our troops.
Robin Wilt is running for Congress, WILT, wiltforcongress.com. Four Democrats running in the primary that is June 26th, just 7 weeks from today. This, of course, is the seat that was filled for a long time by Louise Slaughter, who passed away recently. Let's get our only break of the hour, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what her son experienced in the Pacific Northwest at school and what happened in that case, how that has perhaps informed some of her views on issues ranging from social justice, Black Lives Matter, the policy she's seeing coming out of Washington and more. And there's a new Reuters Ipsos poll that shows millennials and younger voters, which are a big constituency for Democrats, are losing enthusiasm for the midterm elections. Bad news for Dems if they want to not only maintain their seats, but carve into that Republican lead and maybe take back the House. I want to ask Robin why she thinks that may be happening and where she sees the enthusiasm and support of young voters coming from. So a lot to talk about with the candidate when we come back right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, students talking about race and what they see as racism in local schools. Since 2016, there have been a number of summits under the umbrella of the Rock to Change Student Summit on Race. And the most recent was on March 23rd, hosted by Churchville Chi-Life. We're going to talk to some of the students who attended about the conversations they had and their experiences with race in schools next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before we continue with our first in a series of conversations with the candidates for the congressional seat that was once held by Louise Slaughter for so many years before her passing recently, I want to welcome our producer, Megan Mack, because we are on our second day of our spring membership campaign. Hello.
Hello. Yes, day two of the membership campaign. And take a moment to think about the conversation that you're hearing on Connections today. We're talking with a congressional candidate for a full hour. We're taking your calls and your questions both online and on the phone. Think about where else you can have this kind of access to a candidate. I don't think there's anywhere else in town, Evan, where someone's getting an hour to talk with a congressional candidate. And we're doing that with all of the candidates here on the talk show. And this wouldn't be possible with your support. Any gift amount that you can make supports Connections and the programming that we do here. So if you're enjoying the conversation today, if you're learning something today, call 454-6300 and pledge your gift of support to WXXI. And Evan, these conversations will continue. We're talking about some important political concepts and issues, and always our listeners are involved in how we shape our programming. So we need your support.
All right. What's the number again, by the way?
454-6300. You can also go online to WXXINews.org and make your gift there.
Okay. And don't confuse that with the show number, but call both. That would be fine.
Yeah, I'm back on the phones in just a second. Give me 30 seconds.
Thank you, Megan Mack, producer. We continue with Robin Wilt, who was just mentioning during our brief break that you think maybe you see an answer as to why. And again, the latest Reuters-Ipsos poll on young voters does not show that young voters are tilting Republican in the midterms. But there's a 9-point peel off in enthusiasm for Democrats to win back the House, which is a bad sign for Democrats if they want to win nationally. They need not only the support of young voters, they need to convince them to vote, which has historically not always been that easy. And you mentioned during our brief break that you see some perhaps a reason there. What is it?
Yeah, I think the candidates that we select to run for office has a direct correlation to the enthusiasm out there. And I think tapping into some of that fervor that was within the Bernie Sanders campaign is what we need. And those relate directly back to his policies. I know that our younger voters are saddled with student debt. So we need to address some of those issues like education, K through 16 education being available to everyone. We need to address issues like single payer healthcare. We need to address Black Lives Matter and police brutality. Those issues that got younger voters off the couch, we need to be standing with them on those issues.
The Democratic Party, I think, and again, I'm going to overgeneralize here at my own peril, but I think in recent years, take single payer, which we've talked a lot about this hour already. The Democratic Party, I wonder if in private company, President Obama would have said, sure, I'm for single payer, but it's not saleable. Or if many Democrats would have said the same thing, that you can't sell this thing. It's a non-starter. It's what has become known as a socialist issue. And it's tarred that way, and it's just not doable. And do you see the Democratic Party giving up too easily on issues like that as perhaps appealing to young voters?
Well, absolutely. I think we heard from a caller just now, Mary, who considers herself conservative in a lot of regards, but she is a single-payer advocate. And I think that a lot of these policies that are considered maybe pie in the sky are actually very populist policies that affect everyday working families. And people know that the system is broken. And they want to see bold steps taken to make sure that that system works for everyone.
All right, let me grab another phone call. This is Sam in Rochester. Next, I'm with Robin Wilt, who's running for Congress. Go ahead, Sam.
Thank you for taking my call, Evan. She's about to hear better than this. Louis Schlumpfer had a program with veterans, and he also had a gentleman in his office who did nothing but take care of the veterans' problems that veterans have. Now, if you are elected, you got to do one thing. You got to go out on the rest of the road to the veterans' outreach out there, and you have to retrain or replace all of the people that's there, because the care there is. I don't think that people have been trained enough. And the reason I say that is because I had slow-growing lymphoma cancer. And when I had slow-growing lymphoma cancer, it was just this year. And I was blessed enough that God got rid of it. But they did not understand that taking insulin and steroids would make the insulin null and void. And that I would need to take more insulin. So I had to call her off every time I need more insulin. But the people, even the doctors, the nurses, did not understand that. And to go to school with be a doctor and be out there, and to be a nurse and be out there, and you don't know that steroids make insulin null and void, something is wrong in that process. So if you get elected, you got to go out there and you have to retrain those people.
Sam, I got to jump in because we're losing your call, and I'm not sure I'm hoping you're not calling from the middle of a tornado. I hope you're okay. I couldn't quite hear all of it, but I think Robin got the gist of it, which was in regards to veterans health care and his frustrations with what he has seen as ineptitude in Sam's view. Now, again, this is one particular instance, but what do you make of the phone call there, and how does it impact you as a potential member of Congress?
Well, absolutely, it impacts me. I would say that the fact that Sam routinely called Louise's office and she was responsive to him on those personal issues is exactly the type of governance that I would like to emulate. In so far as the veterans care is concerned, I think one of the things that we need to look at is in this huge military budget, how much are we devoting to our veterans? I think there's a lot of money that is within the budget that is devoted to weaponry and all the hardware involved in going to war. But how much is the human component of that, and care for our veterans is one of those things that I think has gotten short shrift. And like I say, you know, Congress is a body that is comprised of fewer than 20% women. And I think because of that underrepresentation, a lot of the issues that are central to women and families get short shrift. And so I think it's important that we have a representative in that office that is reflective of the diversity of the 25th Congressional District. I am the only mother in this race, and I think that perspective is valuable.
All right, we're talking to Robin Wilt, who is running for Congress. We'll work in more of your questions before we get to the end of the hour. You talked about wanting to be a responsive member of Congress like you saw Congresswoman Louise Slaughter. But people in Congress have to spend a lot of time just raising money. I talked to Stephanie Miner, former mayor of Syracuse, who considered running against John Katko in the district over there. And she has decided to at least think about focusing on the governor's office instead, because she told me, first and foremost, I do not want to spend more than half my day just raising money. Are you ready for that? Would you want to? Is there anything you could do to change that? I can't imagine anybody likes doing that.
No, nobody does like doing that. And I think it also creates for incorrect incentives. Money in politics is definitely a problem. I would be looking to do something about Citizens United. I think that ruling was wrongheaded. I think it's ridiculous that so much of our GDP actually goes to running for office. I think our money would be better spent elsewhere. And that is why, in my campaign at least, we are focused on individual donors. This is a very grassroots-focused campaign. It's people-powered, people-centric. And so that, you know, we do not have corporate donors. We do not have money from PACs even. These are all individual contributions that are being made to my campaign.
All right. So real quick on a couple of short answer issues before we then turn to some a broader issue. Minimum wage on the federal level should be what?
At least $15 an hour. I would actually support a universal basic income.
You support a you'd be a universal basic income.
Yes.
But at least starting with the wage, baseline minimum $15 federal level.
That is correct.
Attached to inflation, so it goes up all the time without having to consider it again every 2 or 3 or 5 years?
Yes.
Okay, $15 at least attached to inflation, supporting a universal basic income, which we've talked about on this program, but listeners, it's absolutely worth at least reading up on. That's not necessarily an endorsement or a condemnation, but it's worth reading up on. Legalization of recreational marijuana, for it or against it?
Because of the disparities in enforcement, I do support legalization of cannabis.
Okay, on a recreational level, not just medically.
Not just medically.
Okay, let's talk about some of those disparities. And I mentioned that your son went through an ordeal when you were living in the Pacific Northwest.
Yes.
And why don't you tell the story, because it led to a case that your family name is now helping establish case law in Washington. What happened?
Yeah. Well, you know, and I should mention that I have two sons that are on the autistic spectrum, and this son is on the autistic spectrum. So I think that was one of the things that made him stand out for this person. He's kind of quirky, and I think that what was easy to pick out was his race, not necessarily the fact that he thinks a little bit differently. So my son was being called racial epithets. He wasn't called the N-word like I was, but he was bullied
because
of his race. No, in middle school, This was, he was in seventh grade. And we complained to the teacher first, and she really thought that my son was part of the problem, which was horrific to us. And then we took it to the administration, first the principal, then the superintendent, and then we ended up before the school board. Eventually, because the case was not handled correctly, the perpetrator was never disciplined. The teachers obviously did not react responsibly. We ended up before an administrative law judge arguing our case, and she agreed with us that the school does have some requirement to protect its students when they are being bullied. So that even if it is peer-on-peer harassment, because I think a lot of schools kind of look at it as, well, we can't, you know, kids won't always be nice to one another, and kids will be kids, and bullying happens. Well, in this case, they found that the school did have a responsibility to do something, and if what they did didn't work, then they had a responsibility to do something else. And so that's what the case law established, basically.
When it comes to racial disparity in this country, one of your platforms on your website is about, quote, ending the war on Black lives. So when you describe a war on Black lives, what do you mean specifically?
I mean specifically different means of enforcement in Black communities. I mean, you know, we've had several instances. It's not just driving while Black. It's buying coffee while Black.
Yes, we had a conversation about the Philadelphia arrest last week.
Right. Yeah. It is. When you are a Black person in this society, you are never going to be given the benefit of the doubt. And that's something that's hard for me, raising three Black sons. I would hate for them to be put in a position where they are racially profiled and something terrible happens as a result. And so for me, it's very personal. We know that there are disparities in enforcement. We know that profiling happens because we have the statistics. So let's do something about that. And also having a brother and a son who are in the military or who were in the military, I know that the rules of engagement are different. And if we are policing a civilian population, then why are the standards for engagement lower? It makes no sense at all.
It's one thing to say what you're saying right now on a talk show or on a website and take the disposition that says we have to make change here. But change probably has to come in different directions here. It has to come in education, in the way we interact every day, and probably some policy change. And I'm wondering if you do see congressional policy as part of this, and if so, what that is, if you're in Congress.
I do. I think depending on where you live in the country, you encounter very different standards with regard to policing. I think that, and I think those standards should be federalized. I think that I think we enjoy generally good policing in New York for the most part. But I would like to see, A, accountability increased, and I would like to see some type of federalization of standards for policing.
A federalization of standards for police. And when it comes to what you're seeing out of Washington right now with this administration, do you think that this administration meets the standard that some, usually Democrats, but not always, have set for most racist, most divisive? Do you think some of it's theatrical? Do you think that they are divisive for effect, for political effect? Or do you think they're misunderstood? How do you view this administration?
I view this administration as extremely divisive. And I have been part of the resistance. And I think that people are reacting to what is essentially a threat on their democracy. And I think that people feel that not all voices are being heard. I there's definitely a sense that some lives are more valuable than others. And I think that we as Americans are reacting to that. I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen increased engagement.
You talk on your website about welcoming immigrants and refugees as a federal policy, something you'd like to see more support for if you're a member of Congress. You've talked about your parents, your family, your first-generation American, the way that's impacted you personally. And usually when we have these kinds of conversations, we have some conservative listeners say, okay, you're obviously going to oppose a wall or deportation, et cetera, et cetera. What limits would you place on immigration? What would be the standards if you were creating sort of from scratch an immigration policy? What would it look like?
Well, I think we need to, again, be human focused. I think we need humane immigration policies. I think we've seen families separated. I think that we've seen people put under siege where they literally cannot plan for the next day because they don't know if they're going to be scooped up by ICE. And I think that's inhumane. And we need to come up with some sort of policy that does grant status to people who can't DACA again should be instituted. But we need to go beyond that. We need some resolution for people who are here illegally.
Should there be any annual quota for what we allow for immigration?
We've always had some sort of quota system, and I think a reasonable, again, at very least, I feel like we're pushing back against things that have just gone too far. I mean, visa statuses for people who are coming over working are threatened now. So at very least, we need to stem the tide.
But in our remaining minutes, let's just talk a little bit about who you are and what you've done in this community. Started a real estate brokerage. When did you do that?
Oh, gosh, that was back in 2004.
And you've enjoyed that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And as a business owner, does that give you perspective that you could take to Washington?
Absolutely. Running your own business in this economic environment is tough. And we've had our bits and valleys, but, you know, we've been able to do it. And it's something that I'm very proud of. And being a working mom, too, trying to balance those priorities, it's been a ride.
Do you think with this midterm that the so-called Trump tax cuts are going to help Republicans? Are you hearing from other small business owners, people who sort of in similar positions saying, look, I may not like XYZ, but my tax bill is going to be better. I have to consider voting for that, or no?
I'm sorry.
Do you think the tax bill?
The tax reform bill. Oh, my gosh, the tax reform.
Is it going to help Republicans? Should it help Republicans?
It should not help Republicans because, again, the money did not go to your everyday worker. These were corporate tax breaks. Right now, we are at a point where the disparity between the lowest wage earners and the highest is something like 800 times. And most people think it's like 1 to 50. So, and they hasn't been that equal since 1970. So we have been going through an increase in disparity in incomes that's just unsustainable.
And finally, as a member of the Brighton Town Board, you've already been working on a number of things. In our last 90 seconds, why don't you tell us about some of the things you've been working on locally?
Sure. Obviously, inclusion, diversity, and equity is one of the primary focuses and one of the tenets of our community rally, really, is one of the values. So I did help to establish the Inclusion, Diversity, and Equity Advisory Board in Brighton, and I'm happy to say that we have an overwhelming response. We had more than 15 resumes come in, and we're currently constituting that committee. And if people have an interest, we are still looking for additional resumes to review. Also, we were able to become the first town in Monroe County in Brighton to institute the community choice aggregation local law, which enables us to now select a CCA or community choice aggregation administrator and move down that process of sourcing our energy hopefully more sustainably and also achieving better value for our residents. So
every time I have a conversation, and I don't talk very much about climate change, and it's a political conversation, I've probably failed a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I'll just tell you that on Robin Wilt's website, wiltforcongress.com, there's a section under a sustainable and livable environment, and yes. I know you care about those as well. Let's talk about that next time you come on. Can we do that?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time, Evan.
Wiltforcongress.com, W-I-L-T, and you'll be back for a debate on this program before the primary?
I hope to.
Okay. That's a yes.
That's a yes.
We're taking that as a yes. Robin Wilt today, Rachel Barnhart on Friday of this week, Adam McFadden next week, Joe Morelli before the end of this month. You will hear all of the Democrats running in the June 26th primary. It is coming up again. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Short break, more connections coming up.